Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, a podcast about the United States and the world in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. I'm your host, Michael Patrick Cullinane. Welcome back to the show. When did the cloak and dagger world of modern intelligence gathering begin? When did spooks and spies trade in secrets and counter-espionage? Naturally, if we're talking about it on this show, the answer is the Gilded Age and Progressive Era. Now, I would not have thought that that was the case, but this week we are joined by Mark Stout from Johns Hopkins University, where he teaches at the Advanced Academic Programs Division. Mark was, before being an educator, an intelligence analyst with the State Department and the Central Intelligence Agency. More recently, he teaches global security studies, and he is the co-editor of Georgetown University Press's Studies in Intelligence History book series. He's also a contributing editor to the website War on the Rocks. So who better to have written the book on pre-World War II intelligence history? Mark's book is aptly titled World War I and the Foundations of American Intelligence. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Well, let me also start off by praising this book. I really like it. And let me tell you why I like it so much. It's exactly the kind of study that shows the evolution of something before we often consider the genesis. So in this case, we're talking about intelligence. And your basic thesis is that modern military intelligence did not spring from the creation of the Central Intelligence Agency, but had a long tail stretching all the way back to before World War I. So how does the Great War and the Gilded Age transform intelligence gathering? And how can we define modern as opposed to not modern intelligence?
Yeah, no, so that's a great set of questions there. On the modern versus not modern side, what I'm looking at is the question of the development of the various sub-disciplines of intelligence. And I'm arguing that if you've got those in place in a recognizable way, in a way that would be recognizable to intelligence professionals of World War II or, frankly, up to the current day, that you've got modern intelligence. So what do I mean by that? By the end of the First World War, the United States had people who were conducting espionage operations, recruiting and running spies. We had people who were doing signals intelligence, code breaking, and then deriving intelligence from that and some other related ways of deriving intelligence from radio signals. We had people doing aerial photography and photo interpretation to derive intelligence. We had people using open source intelligence, so reading German newspapers or whatever it is to get information. We had analysts who were taking these masses of information and figuring out what in them was useful and what was going on, transforming that raw information, if you will, into what we would today call finished intelligence. We had people conducting counterintelligence and counter-espionage operations on the defensive side. And we were even conducting, and this is sort of the most anemic of all of these, but we were even conducting what we would recognize today as covert action. So basically, those are the disciplines that make up the bulk of the intelligence profession these days as well. And those were all there by the end of by November 11th, 1918. That's basically what I'm arguing.
So yeah, so that's great. And I think, and it often I think is overlooked in how we consider military history. Certainly, I don't think a lot of people think about the Spanish-American War and intelligence. And you dedicate a great deal, well, a chapter of your book to that, and then a chapter to the Philippines. So we can set this up a little bit for folks that might not be aware of subdisciplines of military intelligence. I'll be honest, I didn't think about intelligence that way until I read your book.
Good.
Yeah, you answered the what of this. I want to get to the who and the where. So who are the major innovators in these subdisciplines of intelligence, and where are they working in the Gilded Age, given that there is no central intelligence agency?
I argue in the book that it's during World War I that you get the full blossoming of all of these various subdisciplines. But the fundamental notion of having intelligence organizations, intelligence staffs or agencies or whatever, comes out of basically the 1870s and the 1880s. And, you know, the United States, in every war that it had fought previously, 1812 pretty marginally, but nonetheless, in every war, the armies that went into the field had conducted intelligence operations. And the primary tools of, you know, the intelligence business at that time were the telescope, the pencil, the paper, and the horse. And that was about it. Right. And these were not typically differentiated staff functions. It was, you know, given to cavalry or whoever was able to conduct whatever, you know, observational, usually, activity needed to be done. Now, during the Civil War, both the Federal Army and also the Confederate Army put together very sophisticated intelligence staffs that were actually doing some pretty high speed stuff across a number of these disciplines. But when the war ended, obviously the Confederate Army vanished with its intelligence staff and its intelligence lessons learned. But also, because on the Union side, these intelligence efforts had been primarily at the level of armies in the field, not the War Department in Washington. Again, when there's this, you know, massive demobilization, all those organizations go away and basically no lessons are retained. So in the post-Civil War era, the Army and the Navy, for that matter, too, go through a lengthy period of doldrums and are really in all kinds of ways falling far behind the world standards, right? At one point, there's a reference work done out of Britain comparing various navies around the world, and the U.S. Navy is ranked behind those of Peru and Egypt and Greece and whatnot. You know, we are not at the cutting edge of much of anything. So what then develops in both the Navy and the Army is a reform movement starting in the 1870s. The key initial effort was taken by the Army. In 1875, Commanding General William Tecumseh Sherman sends a Civil War veteran, a guy named Emory Upton, on a tour around the world to see what armies around the world are doing that we can learn from. And when he comes back, and in 1878, he delivers his report, and actually it's published as a book, The Armies of Asia and Europe. And basically he says, look, on the organizational and administrative side, we're way behind in all these different ways. And he had a whole slew of recommendations. And one of his recommendations is to create an intelligence office within the War Department. And what he's doing here is he's really following on particularly European and especially German innovations, or, you know, the steps that they've been taking. Between 1861 and 1871, the Germans had fought a series of three very successful wars, first against Austria and Hungary, then against Denmark, and then against France. And they'd been wildly successful. And one of the things that had enabled that success was that the Prussian general staff had an organization in it that was devoted to gathering data about adversaries or potential adversaries, right? So we're in an era where war is rapidly industrializing, and it's now things like, you know, how many rail cars can we get from point A to point B, and how many men can we mobilize in 1 week, and how many artillery pieces can we produce per month, and how many of those men can we get from their barracks to, you know, the border of Denmark or wherever in how much time. Very data intensive. And so the Germans, of course, are studying these kinds of questions about their own militaries to know their own capabilities so they can also write war plans. But they realize they need an office to look at the adversary and do the same calculations on behalf of the adversary. And that's what Emory Upton says, hey, we need to create. The Navy is actually the first to basically do this. They established the Office of Naval Intelligence in 1883. And then the War Department, I think, seriously, at least in part because they didn't want to be shown up by the Navy, created what became known as the Military Intelligence Division in 1885. And these were basically meant to be the data guys who were looking primarily at adversaries so that we could plan wars. And also one other aspect of this, particularly with the Navy, though also with the Army or the War Department, is they also used these intelligence organizations to acquire information about the latest military, naval and military technologies. You know, what are the innovations in armor on battleships in Europe? And what are the latest, you know, engines for driving ships and those sorts of things, because we've fallen so far behind. And basically what I argue then is that these things carry on with some, you know, some fits and starts, but carry on until World War One. And then of course, World War One leads to, you know, it's huge, right? And innovation in the intelligence realm just accelerates rapidly.
Thanks. I think that does give us a sense of, you know, I think today too, of course, the military intelligence occurs within the branches as well, within the, you know, sort of military branches like the Marines and the Navy, they have that as well. But I was really interested to learn that the State Department had a pretty good Bureau of Secret Intelligence.
That's absolutely right. It's a really interesting story, and I'm hoping to write something that's specifically focused on this. But what happened was, so World War One, of course, starts in Europe in the late summer of 1914. The United States will not end up joining the war until April of 1917. So we got a 2.5 or so year gap in there during which the war is going on, but we are neutral. But during this period, the United States is selling munitions and ammunition to the Allies, but not to the Germans or the Austro-Hungarians, number one. And number two, there's a big public debate, if you will. There's not any sort of a unified view among the American public who we should be rooting for, or if indeed we should be rooting against all of them because this is to enrich, you know, fat cat capitalists, which was more the socialist view. The support of the American public for one side or the other was very much up in play. So given these two things, the Germans and also to a lesser degree the Austro-Hungarians, primarily through their embassies and consulates in the United States, were conducting what we would call influence operations, propaganda operations, if you will, and also sabotage operations. The Germans, for instance, mounted a campaign to sabotage American ships, which were carrying ammunition to the French, the British, the Russians, and firebomb them specifically. And there were 30-some U.S. ships where firebombs went off, or in I think one or two cases, if I recall correctly, were discovered before they went off. No ships were sunk, but you know this was not a good thing. And there were other sabotage operations too, an effort to blow up a bridge connecting Maine with Canada, and a couple of ammunition dumps were blown up, most famously including one in New Jersey called Black Tom, which was a small island that was an ammo dump. At that time, it had ammunition destined for Russia, and German agents, or agents recruited by Germany, more specifically, blew it up, which caused tremendous damage in the, you know, the New York area. In fact, I've never been there, but I'm told that you can still see chips and scars on the Statue of Liberty created by this. So there's a lot of stuff. And of course, the Germans are also conducting intelligence operations to support people, populations in the United States that didn't necessarily like the British. So the East Indian population, for instance, and also the British and the Germans were in a big sort of clandestine / covert war with each other in the United States. So there was a lot of central power intelligence activity, some of it literally violent, going on in the United States. And so the State Department started an intelligence effort, a counterintelligence effort, to try and collect on this and to keep it under control. Now, some of this work was actually done here in the United States by State Department employees, but they also borrowed, if you will, Secret Service agents and other agents from other bits of the federal government to do this work for them. And slowly, even before the United States was in war, it actually started turning into also not just the domestic counterintelligence and sort of security effort, but also into collecting intelligence clandestinely outside the country. And during the war itself, the State Department was conducting espionage operations that, you know, the nature of which would look very similar to people in the CIA today, in places like Revolutionary Russia and Switzerland and some other places. So yeah, State Department became an important player.
I think our friends that work in diplomatic history would be really interested to learn that there was a bureau like that. I mean, but it does in some ways make sense. And what I really like about your book is that the intelligence gathering that you talk about requires intelligence. I mean, it's really a story of professionalization, the growth of expertise, and to a degree, intellectualism. Am I right in saying that?
Oh, that's absolutely right. Yes, that's absolutely right. There are certainly lots of people during the period of my book who are put in intelligence jobs who should not have been there. Okay. That said, there is definitely an understanding among the, you know, the thought leaders and the people who are sort of reflect on this business that most intelligence work requires people who have something between their ears, right? And know how to think and know how to reason. That's number one. And number two, the other aspect that you touched on is it becomes clear to, I mean, even as early as these reformers who were thinking about these kinds of issues in the 1870s and 1880s, that the traditional American method of dealing with intelligence, for lack of a better word, is we don't do much of anything until there's a war. And then we stand up an intelligence effort for the duration of the war, and then we get rid of it after the war. Well, they say that's not satisfactory because for modern war, right, these industrialized wars with mass mobilization and railways and telegraphs and whatever, right? There's a lot of information you need to collect before the war because you won't have time during the war. The generals will need it, right? But you won't have time during the war to collect it, and it will be more difficult to collect. Right. In peacetime, for instance, we have Army and Navy attachés who are accredited to our, I forget if it was an embassy or legation. I think it was a legation in Berlin, for instance. They can collect just overtly. They can collect intelligence. We can send officers either, clandestinely or openly to go visit Germany. They can acquire maps. They can take, go around the countryside and make notes about where there are fortifications or whatever the heck, right? There's a lot of things you can do in peacetime to collect information that your generals are going to need that they will not have the time and the ability to get during wartime. So intelligence, it starts being understood as something that we need to be doing all the time. Yeah, we'll step it up when there's a war, but we need to be doing it all the time. Otherwise, we're setting ourselves up for failure.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional.
Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Yeah, I think that's, for me, this period is so important from that professionalization and expert building perspective. I think it happens across all of the major agencies. I also really like the other myth that your book busts, which is that the British are so much better at intelligence gathering than anyone else. I mean, you mentioned the Germans there, but certainly that they're better than the Americans. And that's not entirely so, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I guess I'd make a couple of points about this. So, it's widely held, certainly not universally, but it's widely held that, you know, what the United States knows about intelligence, it learned from the British, primarily in World War II. And that, you know, we did in fact work a lot with the British during the World War II era and subsequently for that matter, and did indeed learn from them. But we were learning from the British earlier than that, you know, before World War I, by reading professional journal articles. A great number of articles from British professional military journals were reprinted in American military journals. But also, and equally importantly, we were learning from the French, from the Germans, to a lesser degree from the Austro-Hungarians. And I've even seen a few, I don't want to overemphasize this, but a few articles in the journals of the time that about intelligence-related matters that were reprinted from Argentinian military journals. So the United States was very much learning from all of the leading powers, that sort of the people on the cutting edge of intelligence business, from, as I say, from the beginning of this reform movement. In fact, looking at what foreigners were doing was a big inspiration for us, and the leader there was Germany, with France as a close second, all the way up through World War I. And while I think it is fair to say that during the American time in World War I, we never quite got our intelligence efforts up to the level of what the British and the French were doing, but we were pretty close by the end. We were very rapid studies once it got going. And, you know, by the end of World War I, we were American intelligence efforts, American intelligence personnel were viewed with, you know, respect as solid colleagues and partners by their, you know, primarily by their British and French counterparts, because that's mostly who we worked with.
I wondered about that. Is there a language difficulty here? I mean, that the United States is probably, it might be easier to learn from the likes of the British, certainly because they have the same language, but the French and German, there's plenty of French and German speakers in the United States. Japan, Russia, maybe other countries is a little bit harder. Is that something that you found in your research?
Didn't focus a whole lot on that per se, but what I can say, a couple thoughts on that. So first, during the period of the war itself, you know, with the American Expeditionary Forces in France, our forces are stationed primarily with the French on their left and their right. Right. But we do loan some divisions to the British, and there's learning going on here in both directions. And obviously, more American soldiers speak English than speak French. So there's a certain ease of this communication, obviously, in a, both a formal and informal kinds of ways between the Americans and the British, certainly. But also, I should say that when General Pershing's G2, so his chief intelligence officer, a guy named ultimately Brigadier General Dennis Nolan, a real intellectual, by the way. When he comes over, when Pershing and Nolan come over, they realize that they need to establish sort of regulations, if you will, for the conduct of AEF intelligence. And basically what they do is they borrow the intelligence regulations from one of the five British armies. And I forget which it was, but they basically take that as their starting point and then do some minor edits. So sort of the day in, day out procedures, it's more or less the headquarters level for how intel is going to work, are essentially borrowed from the British. And we borrow other things from the British too. But the French, we're interacting more with the French. And if you start looking at that sort of next level down of detail in intelligence matters, the American Expeditionary Forces were translating and incorporating as their what we would call field manuals or tactical manuals today, or technical manuals rather, French doctrinal documents, just translating them from French and slapping the AEF logo on them and disseminating them to the troops. So a lot of the more micro level regulations, instructions, whatever, on how American troops were to conduct intelligence activities were borrowed from the French. The top level stuff borrowed from the British, the lower level stuff borrowed from the French.
No, that makes perfect sense. I mean, I think that really adds to what I was saying, because obviously there is a language barrier there, at least in terms of how many people speak foreign languages, in French, German, and Spanish and English, obviously, are the top languages for the US. But of course they were in the field by World War One with the British and French. So that makes perfect sense.
One quick thought I want to put out on Japan. Japan was of increasing concern from, you know, basically the turn of the century, 1898, you know, 1900, up through World War One, as being a potential American rival. And they were on the Allied side during World War One, but the Americans were as deeply suspicious of the Japanese and their intentions, and also of the what they perceived as being fairly widespread Japanese espionage aimed at, you know, U.S. or U.S. interests, or sniffing perilously close to us. But that language barrier was a real problem. And, you know, the United States is going to find both before World War One and then, you know, in the years, sure, you know, between in the interwar period, that Japan is a really, what we would call today, a hard target to collect on. Not only is it, you know, a language that not a lot of people in the intelligence world speak, but also internal to Japan, there's tremendous, you know, internal security efforts, right? It's in a lot of ways analogous to the, you know, the great difficulties that the CIA had on collecting human intelligence in the Soviet Union, you know, were problems that the US was facing collecting on Japan from turn of the century, well up to World War II, really.
Turn of the century takes us back in a way that I have so many questions about the American Expeditionary Forces, but I have a big question about the Philippines, because it's often been said the Philippines is one of the major testing grounds for American military intelligence. So what are the successes and failures there during the Philippine-American War, and how do they then leave a legacy for later intelligence activities?
Yeah, so the Philippine War starts out inauspiciously from the intelligence angle, but ends with some fairly impressive efforts underway. So, you know, when the decision was made that, you know, we're going to fight Spain, and part of that is going to be a campaign in the Philippines, there was essentially no intelligence worth mentioning available on what was on the Philippines and what was going on in the Philippines. I forget if it was Army intelligence or Navy intelligence offhand, but at one point, all they could deliver was a copy of an article from the Encyclopedia Britannica on the Philippines, and they stamped confidential on it, right? And you know, the decision to basically, you know, make the Philippines an American possession was also made on the basis of bad intelligence. The commanding general, a U.S. commanding general, he was trying to collect human intelligence on sort of the popular feelings and the politics and whatnot inside the Philippines, but particularly in the Manila area. But he and his intel folks didn't think adequately carefully about this, and all of their sources about what was on the minds of the people and what the popular sentiments were from the economic upper classes in Manila. And from them, they determined that, you know, what the Filipinos really, really want is to be, you know, owned by the United States. And basically that decision went forward, and lo and behold, that actually wasn't the way most Filipinos felt. It was the way a certain slice of the upper crust in Manila felt, but didn't generalize. And so we end up with an insurgency that goes on for quite some time. In that insurgency, however, some really solid intelligence efforts were undertaken. And the U.S. Army realized very early on that it needed to create an intelligence organization whose job specifically was to focus on the insurgents. And they put together file card systems, really, on, named insurgents and sort of, influencers, for lack of a better term, priests and whatnot, who might interact with or have some potential influence positively or negatively on the insurgency. And these card files were held not only at the Bureau of Insurgent Records at the Army headquarters, but also down through the levels of, the military echelons. And so the way this would work would be, I'm making this up, is some regiment somewhere acquires information about, some insurgents we didn't know about, or, information to, add further detail or to update what we knew about a particular set of insurgents operating in their area. Okay, so they would make or update, a file card for their own records, and then they'd send copies up the chain. So the next higher headquarters and then the central headquarters, the Bureau of Insurgent Records at the Army level in the Philippines, would also get copies of this. So everybody had sort of the common picture as to who are we fighting and what do we know about them in various places around the country. And if higher headquarters got new information about people operating in that regiment's area, they would make out a card for themselves and they'd send one up and they'd send one down to the people who were actually on the ground in that bit of the Philippines. File card systems were pretty high speed information technology at the time. And the US Army made really, really good use of those. And it brought that idea and sort of the ethos of thinking about counterinsurgency, which has a lot in common with counterintelligence, back to the Military Intelligence Division in Washington. And a lot of that came through basically one guy, a guy named Ralph Van Diemen, who worked on this in the Philippines for the Army, and then ends up heading the Military Intelligence Division for roughly the first year the United States is in the war, and then goes off to become a senior advisor in, if I recall correctly, April of 1918, I may be wrong in the precise month, but he goes off to become a senior intelligence advisor to Dennis Nolan, General Pershing's intel officer in France. He's viewed as the father of American military intelligence. That's a term you'll hear frequently. And he really cut his teeth in the Philippines, conducting intelligence operations on and building card files on Filipino insurgents.
That's really interesting. I mean, I think some of the other things that we hear so frequently about are, say, the water cure as a counter, counterintelligence,
as an interrogation tool, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Or also the intel failures that might have led to the Battle of Bajau and the basically massacre of hundreds of women, children. What about those in the Philippines? How are those sort of fed into the American war machine to try and, to learn from lessons, or maybe they're not learned at all?
On the water cure, one or two thoughts there. So yeah, this was to enhance interrogation, term I swear I've heard somewhere before. And I'm sure that a lot of the information obtained from those interrogations using the water cure ended up in these card files. I mean, I can't cite chapter and verse, but it stands to reason. But I would say also the water cure was one of the reasons that the US Army did not publish its history of the Philippine War and did not make any effort to formal effort, that is to say, to disseminate lessons learned in the Philippines to the broader army. Now, as I've said, some of the intel lessons came back, but particularly through specific personalities. You've been there and now we're in Washington or now we're in France, whatever. But the United States public in general was pretty queasy about many of them about the water cure, pretty ugly thing. And also more broadly, sort of at the philosophical level, right? Americans took seriously this notion that, we fought a revolution to be free of, foreign domination. And we believe that people should be able to determine that, populations should be able to determine their own destinies. And we weren't kind of sympathetic to these Filipinos who want to have independence from their, you know, colonial overlords. Like, we, you know, it's kind of just like the United States has simply replaced Spain in that regard, which was, you know, more or less true, right? And so there was, the whole war left the United States Army and the U.S. public with a just sort of a sense of unease. And so the that led basically then to the Army not wanting to talk about it. So a lot of the lessons about counterinsurgency, for instance, that were, you know, hard-won lessons in that war were not disseminated and not carried on except in an informal sense, largely through personalities.
I mean, that sort of leads me to a question about whether politics has much to do with the evolution of the intelligence community.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. And, you know, it depends on how you think about what is politics. I would say that reform movement of the 1870s, 1880s that led to the creation of the first two intelligence organizations in the U.S., ONI, or enduring ones, ONI and the Military Intelligence Division of the War Department, they weren't in it. They were driven by sort of bottom-up zealous reformers in the Army and the Navy, not driven top-down by, you know, Washington-level processes that were politically driven desires to reform the Army and, you know, have an intel office, right? Now, obviously, they fit into a, you know, a broader context about, you know, the kinds of issues that you're an expert in the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era. But they weren't sort of on their face political issues. Now, that said, one of the main components of both military and naval intelligence that we haven't really talked about is, of course, both of these organizations are sending attachés, military attachés or army attachés, navy attachés, to serve at U.S. embassies and legations overseas as military diplomats, but also to collect overt, i.e., you know, freely available intelligence, right? Not recruiting spies to steal secrets, just sending back, you know, to Washington notes on the briefing that the Prussian army just gave, or reporting what's in the Parisian newspapers about what the French Navy is doing or whatever, right? But depending on what president we're talking about, there may be a greater or lesser number of other kinds of tasks. And, you know, some presidents, for instance, see the attachés as, yeah, you've got an intelligence collection or an information collection function, but really what we want you to do is to go out there and get contracts for the United States to, you know, build ships or weapons or whatever for whatever country you're accredited to, right? Dollar diplomacy, basically. And so the amount of effort that they're able to devote to intelligence versus other kinds of efforts, you know, waxes and wanes primarily with the presidents. And the other thing, I just briefly on the attachés, I'd note, being an attaché was a difficult business. Well, let me phrase this. It was difficult to find the right person to do it. So not only would there be issues of like, you know, do you speak the relevant language or not, but also attachés, like diplomats, like State Department diplomats, were expected to, you know, entertain a lot, right? Do representational social functions, right? Have, you know, German officers over to their house for dinner and, you know, whatever all else, right? Throw cocktail parties for all the attachés in London, whatever. But there wasn't a government allowance to do this. So really the only people who could actually serve as attachés were those who not only hopefully had the relevant language skills and appropriate rank, but also who were more or less independently wealthy. And so they could afford to throw a whole lot of parties. On behalf of the U.S. government, but unreimbursed.
Right, absolutely. Just like the diplomatic corps at this time as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, well, let me ask a question for a friend here. Professor Sam Edwards, who is at Loughborough University. I know he's researching on the AEF. And what was the intelligence operations of the American Expeditionary Forces? You mentioned that they were on the flank of the French in World War One, but what are they doing in terms of intelligence on the ground?
Yeah, so good question. The AEF has its G2 shop under Dennis Nolan, and then it quickly then as you know, the First Army and then corps and divisions under that are built, it replicates miniature versions of that down the various echelons, down to the tactical level. And again, it's one of these vertically integrated kinds of things in a lot of ways, much like how I was just mentioning the file cards about Filipino insurgents would be sent up and down the chain, right? Similar sorts of things going on in the AEF. The AEF had four big branches. One was G2A, which was about collection and analysis of almost everything. G2B, which did espionage specifically and also counter-espionage in the American rear area and among the U.S. forces, and then C&D, which did mapping and topography and censorship and press relations and a bunch of other things like that. On G2A side, there were people who were doing code breaking, using exploiting rather the German signals intercepted by the Signal Corps, actually code breaking and then decrypting of German messages, tapping German field telephones lines, that sort of thing. There were people doing aerial photography, or more to the point, actually exploiting photography taken by lower echelons. There were people who were reading German newspapers and whatnot when they could get them. There were analysts putting all of this together, sort of the big picture, particularly in order of battle. What is the organization, the strength, and the disposition in space of the German forces we're facing? And this is something where cooperation among the Allies was particularly important, because, and they would share quite freely with each other on this. So, for instance, right, if a German division opposite the British suddenly is pulled out of the line there and sort of somewhere in the German rear area, well, the British would want the French and the Americans to know this, because that division may show up opposite them someday soon, right? And vice versa, for instance. Also more specialized people who are studying the German Air Force, keeping card files on German airfields, even at one point on German pilots, and also doing today what we would call foreign materiel exploitation. So if a German plane crashes or is brought down behind friendly lines, American lines, go look at the plane. And can we learn new things about aeronautical engineering? Look at the cameras that may be on the plane. Can we learn anything from what they're doing there? Machine gun design, have they improved their machine guns recently? All that sort of stuff. The whole range of things going on in this regard. The espionage component of it was fairly modest, I would say. But it was focused less on, interestingly enough, focused less on immediate battlefield things and more on more strategic intelligence collection deep into the enemy rear. And this makes sense. Like, unlike in, well, frankly, all of the previous American wars, this was not a war in which you could easily send people out to, scout behind enemy lines and then return with information, right? It was a continuous front line that had one end at the Swiss border and the other end at the North Sea or the English Channel, right? There weren't flanks to slip around, and so espionage in a sort of an observational kinds of sense, let's penetrate the lines with spies, wasn't really a thing. But what G2B was doing in terms of espionage, and this got going very late, but what it was doing was running networks of agents particularly in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And here, this was largely handled by a guy named Emanuel Victor Voska, who was a Czechoslovak immigrant to the United States. He had been a close ally, confidant of Thomas Masaryk. And through those connections that they had before World War I, they were in connection with various networks of people in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, typically those who belonged to ethnic groups other than the Hungarians and the Austrians, who wanted independence or at least greater autonomy for their people, and who thought that the Allies winning the war would be a way to do that. So we were getting more sort of strategic level espionage collection. Don't want to overstate this, but it was happening from the deep enemy rear about things like military production and domestic morale and, you know, the calorie consumption of the population, that sort of stuff. Voska also was putting together, and how much of this, little bits of this at least came to fruition. How much of it came to fruition, I don't know. But he was using many of these same kinds of networks to conduct what we would call covert action, or at least prepare to conduct covert action, particularly, you know, blowing things up. At one point, there was, you know, discussion of can we block the Danube, for instance. So that was the general flavor of what the AEF itself was doing. And almost everything here was done in greater or lesser cooperation with the British and the French.
So this is, I mean, I hope everyone is understanding how broad this study of intelligence is here. I mean, what we've talked about so far is a lot about espionage, obviously a lot about traditional intelligence gathering, whether it's, you know, listening or having informants. But we're also talking about domestic intelligence. You know, counting calories is not something that that springs to mind when you think about cloak and dagger. But this is, of course, part of it. And I just want to, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of sum this all up, because your book is, it's got the second half of the book really deals in a lot of detail with things like the airplane, the radio, domestic intelligence, and on espionage for sure, the types in a way of intelligence gathering. What are the legacies of the, you know, if we take the book as a whole, what are the legacies of intelligence gathering in this Gilded Age and Progressive Era?
Yeah. So, I mean, if I had to sort of give the big arc of this, right, it's this idea begins to sprout in an era of military reform, sort of after the post Civil War doldrums, and then grows and becomes with fits and starts, as I've said, you know, more sophisticated by the time we enter World War I. Takes off dramatically, both in size and breadth, but also new kinds of endeavors, some of which we talked about, and in sophistication and quality during World War I. Then, of course, after World War II, there's a big demobilization. But, and this is the important part, with the exception of covert action, all of these ideas and the sort of methods of operating and basic functions continue in the United States to World War II, where, of course, again, they get massively expanded again, right? So it's often suggested that the United States, they did some stuff in intelligence in World War I, and then they got rid of all of it, and then they had to build it again in World War II, parentheses, with British help. Well, they didn't get rid of all of it. It continued. And in fact, I looked at the numbers. And during the interwar period, if you correlate the size of the U.S. Army, so the number of soldiers in the U.S. Army, with the number of people in the War Department's Military Intelligence Division, they move almost exactly together, right? Correlation is near perfect, right? And nobody says the U.S. Army went away in the interwar period, but a lot of people seem to think that the U.S. intelligence effort went away in the interwar period. It didn't. It just got slimmed down, but the key ideas carried through to World War II, which then lays the foundation for Cold War and post-Cold War. And they do this in a number of ways. So first off, a number of personalities who were involved in intelligence in World War I go on to be either involved in intelligence in World War II or in senior command positions in World War II. You know, shining example is Joseph Stilwell. He did intel work in the Philippines. Not in the Philippines. He did intel work for the Military Intelligence Division before World War I. In World War I, he was the G2, so the Chief Intelligence Officer for the 4th Corps in France. And then, you know, in World War II, he goes on to be a senior commander in the, as a general, senior commander in the China-Burma-India Theater. And he would have brought what he knew about intelligence with him. That's one example. William Friedman, who was a code breaker in the American Expeditionary Forces in France in the interwar period, he leads the team for the War Department who breaks the Japanese diplomatic cipher that we call Purple. And then he goes on to be a key part of that effort against the SIGINT effort against the Japanese during World War II, and actually ends his career in the early 50s as a senior executive at the National Security Agency. So there are people who go through. There are also, in a sort of the formal sense of organizations continue, I guess I touched on this, but also in the realm of ideas, you know, not specifically written ideas, not specifically ideas in the heads of people. So for instance, right after World War I, many parts of the Army and the War Department wrote, you know, a history of what we did in the war. And a lot of these were actually published publicly. But the Military Intelligence Division in Washington decided, yeah, we're going to do a history, but we're going to make it secret. In fact, we're only going to have one copy of it. And we're going to make it secret so that we can really let it all hang out in this thing, like what we did right, what we did wrong, where we screwed up, what we can learn from the whole kit and caboodle. It's 2,200 pages. But the neat thing is that at least into the early 30s, any new officer who got assigned to the Military Intelligence Division, the first however many days, he was like literally put in an office and said, read the history of what we did in World War I. So it carries through in that way. Also, you see, again, what we would call field manuals and technical manuals and that sort of thing. In, you know, the 3-4 years after World War I, there's a big effort to bring lessons learned from the war into these intelligence field manuals and also field manuals on other military topics. And then those just variegate and get more and more numerous and numerous and numerous right up to World War II. But if you look at what's being written in these doctrinal manuals about intelligence, you can very clearly see the World War I experience in there. It's very clear. It just gets more sophisticated and variegated, if you will, over time. But you can trace really clearly a lot of these ideas and these organizational concepts. And then also, you know, a lot of people start writing, officers write professional military journal articles. They end up on like the staff of the War College or the Command and Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, et cetera, and teach this stuff. So, you know, these ideas, the people, organizations, and ideas all carry through the interwar period, albeit, you know, reduced in volume from what it had been during World War I, and then very much inform what we're doing in World War II, not only in the military side, but also in the OSS, and I would argue actually even to a greater extent, frankly, though this is something I think needs more research, in the CIA. Because in the early days of the CIA, which was formally created in 1947, though there were predecessor organizations for a couple of years before that, most of the people who worked at CIA were actually from the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force. There were very few, initially, very few civilian CIA employees. It was largely people on loan from the military, where they had this intelligence DNA that dated all the way back to World War I and before, sort of in their brains. So anyway, that's a longer answer than you probably wanted, but this is how I argue in my last chapter this carries on and why this isn't just a question of, you know, the Gilded Age up through World War I, but it actually has relevance to later American intelligence history as well.
Yeah, that's why I ask it, because the last chapter does really pull a lot of this together and show us that through line. What it doesn't say in the last chapter is if anyone can fill the shoes of James Bond in the Gilded Age of Progressive Era. Are we going to have a 12 series movie with, I don't know, who would it be? Would there be anyone or not possible?
That's a fine question. And I think the short answer is no. Short answer is no. That's a whole other discussion about spy fiction.
Mark, it's a fantastic book. And I think it really does. What the best histories do is they really challenge our interpretation of the past. Yours does that. It gives us a broad scope of what was happening in the realm of military intelligence and other forms of intelligence too. And it tells us that we were wrong the way we've thought about the long history of intelligence. And so for that, thanks very much. And thanks for joining the show.
Well, thank you so much. This has been wonderful. And thank you for the kind words about the book. And best of luck with your podcast series.
Well, that's all we have time for. Thanks for listening. You can follow the Gilded Age and Progressive Era on Twitter or on my website, michaelpatrickcullinane.com. Please consider subscribing or reviewing the podcast wherever you listen, because it really makes a big difference and helps direct others to the show. I hope you'll join me again for the next episode.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.